Christ with you. And now your host, John Friend.
All right, folks, welcome back to another edition of The Realist Report. This is your host, John Friend. The website is therealistreport.com, where you can find an extensive archive of these podcasts, as well as other programs I have appeared on as a guest over the years. You will also find all of my blog posts and articles, a contact page where you can contact me directly, my Twitter feed, which is embedded in the right-hand sidebar of the website, and many other useful and important links. I am a regular reporter for American Free Press, America's last real newspaper, and I also contribute to the Barnes Review, the bi-monthly history magazine affiliated with American Free Press. As always, I encourage all listeners to subscribe to these publications if they are not already. Please visit AmericanFreePress.net and BarnesReview.org for subscription details. All right, with that said, let me introduce our special guest today. Mark Newhoff is a master's student and a graduate teaching assistant at Virginia Tech University, and he is joining us today. He has come under fire at his university for some of his social media posts and his personal, political, historical, and racial views, which we will be discussing at length today. Mark, welcome to the program. How are you today, sir?
I'm doing fine. Thanks for having me, John.
Yes, this is great. I'm really glad that we were able to get in touch and do this, because prior to me meeting you, you know, you reached out, just a little background, I guess, you actually reached out to American Free Press. I understand you are a subscriber to the newspaper, as well as the Barnes Review, if I'm not mistaken. So thank you very much for
subscribing.
Yes, thank you very much for subscribing, and thank you very much for reaching out, because you've got a very interesting story. And I didn't even hear about this. I can't believe that. I was shocked when, you know, I was looking into what was going on at Virginia Tech, and I had never even heard of it. I didn't even see it covered on any of the alt-right websites, unless I missed it. I mean, I didn't see it at all. So thank you for reaching out. You really do have an interesting story. And to get started, can you kind of just tell us a little bit about yourself, you know, give us some of your, you know, background details? And, you know, whatever you feel comfortable with sharing, you know, please, you know, let us know a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, sure. I come from a normal upper middle class family from Chicagoland, ultimately, studying English, went to Virginia Tech because they offered a master's program for English where it's free tuition and you get a stipend for teaching. So I've come here. Aside from that, I'm very interested in independently reading, forming my own conclusions, reading, you know, dissident.
Oh, Mark, are you there? I think we may have just lost Mark. Mark, can you hear me?
Hello?
Yeah, you totally just cut out for like 10 seconds.
Sorry about that.
The last I heard, you said that the last I heard, or that the recording is probably going to hear, was you said that you like reading and forming your own conclusions. I don't know if you, what else you had to say after that. Yeah, go ahead.
And that's been a problem that's plagued me, not only here.
Right. Yeah. I'm kind of the same way. I like investigating things for myself and coming to my own conclusions. And yeah, it does, in many cases, 9 times out of 10, kind of, you know, run contrary to everything that's in the mainstream. So I feel you on that. I wanted to ask, how long have you been at Virginia Tech, and what has your college experience been like? I went to undergraduate at University of Nebraska, and, you know, I don't remember college being like this super liberal, anti-white environment, at least in my personal experience. You can, you know, you see, you know, like a modern college today, and it seems like it's very anti-white, very liberal. You know, it's all about feminism and just left-wing politics in general. But in my experience, it wasn't really like that. So I'm curious, what has your college experience been like?
Well, I went to college at Northern Illinois University for my undergrad. And prior to that time, I was pretty apolitical. But it's there when I was in the English program that I first heard that phrase, dead white males. And that kind of is the catalyst for a political awakening, I think, where I started to feel attacked as a white person, or at least sidelined or made to feel like I'm part of the villainous group. That, you know, that's when they teach you that whites are the oppressors, imperialists, and all this stuff. So that's when it started, and that's when I started to really do my own critical thinking in undergrad. Coming to grad school now at Virginia Tech, specifically during the election season, I mean, it's like on full throttle now. Yeah, it's all the feminism stuff. I mean, I think that I'm at this university a catalyst for a larger problem. I was talking to a reporter at the Roanoke Times, and he was telling me that ultimately this story isn't even about me. Like, I'm not even the important thing here. What's important is, like, the problem of white supremacy at Virginia Tech, you know? So I'm kind of just a symbol of this perceived problem that I don't think exists and that I think is all completely fabricated.
But these left-wing people really do think that Virginia Tech is, like, run by white supremacists or something? Is that what she's arguing?
Yeah. I mean, I was directing you to that story where it says, like, students march against white supremacy at Virginia Tech. And it's the abstract concept. It's not just against the white supremacist. It's that there's white supremacy at Virginia Tech, which is, of course, obnoxious. I mean, Virginia Tech is any other university. It has a, you know, a department of inclusivity and diversity. You have mandatory diversity seminars that you have to participate in. I mean, it's just like any other university. Everyone bends over backwards to meet with all the the demands of multiculturalism. So this notion that there's a problem of white supremacy is ridiculous.
You know, it really is. And you do see this on, you know, all these college campuses. And it's, as you said, it's really kind of been heating up. It was heating up big time during the election, but even afterwards. Now we have guys like Richard Spencer, for example, going out there and giving speeches at college campuses, and not just Richard Spencer, other, you know, kind of conservative figures. I just saw a video of one of the guys with, I think it's the Gateway Pundit. I can't remember the guy's name off the top of my head, but from what I understand, this guy who's presenting as like a, you know, a more conservative type figure, he's gay and he's Jewish, sort of like, you know, Milo Yiannopoulos, who they paraded around as some like Nazi or something. So it's interesting, and you know, even a guy like this, who again is, from what I understand, gay and Jewish, he's up there, and these students are just freaking out because he's somewhat conservative, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's exactly how it is. This is a modern day witch hunt. I mean, all these words that keep being bandied around. You have white supremacist, you have fascist, neo-Nazi, racist. They all effectively mean the same thing, and it's that you don't agree with multiculturalism, or you have your own opinions about something. They call Ben Shapiro, who's another Jewish conservative, he's a Nazi. They call Donald Trump a fascist when, as we can see, he can barely get anything through in the government. So, and then racist, that's just anyone who doesn't agree with what amounts to white genocide. So
yes, very, very well said. I completely agree. And all these buzzwords, these are weaponized buzzwords that have been used so effectively by the left and by the Jews in particular, by the organized Jewish community and by organized, you know, activist Jewish groups and you know, Jewish ethnic activists as individuals in the media and whatnot, and even in academia as well. I mean, they've used these terms so effectively to smear, to delegitimize anyone that they disagree with, or anybody or anyone that's kind of going against the grain, this, you know, anti-white political correctness. These labels are just thrown at us, and, you know, most people are horrified at it. You know, they don't want to be called a racist. They don't want to be called an anti-Semite, for example. And it keeps us cowered in fear. And I don't have time for that anymore. It seems like you don't either. And there's a lot of other people that are starting to think like us, you know.
Yeah, I reject the force of the labels. It's reached the point where it's kind of someone's trying to give you as a conservative, like the N word. Ultimately, they're trying to find like, what is the word that I can use in order to shut this person down? And those words only have that power if we give them that power. So if we like conservatives right now, like mainstream conservatives, if any of them publicly are called like a racist, they're going to double down and apologize, back off whatever they were doing, etc. But that only means they're giving that word that power. If instead they were called a racist and they just said, I don't care, like what I'm doing is right, you can throw these words at me all you want, but in the end it has no power, then we would see these words diminish in terms of their influence. And I'm kind of getting on board with that. It's just that I need the rest of the society to do that as well, because you're a lot more cavalier than I am, John. And I'd like to get to your point, but I'm getting there.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. No. And we can kind of talk about that. You know, I was actually going to bring this up later on in the conversation, but it might be good to talk about it right now. You had mentioned, you know, when you were an undergrad, you started getting this very anti-white, especially anti-white male perspective in the English department and probably other departments as well. And that led you to start, you know, kind of thinking on your own and consulting alternative sources, etc. So I'm curious, like, what sources did you consult? What authors did you read, or websites maybe, or books even, that kind of influenced you in a more race realist, you know, pro-white perspective?
Well, I first started going to 4chan politics board. You know, I think that's where a lot of people my age start out. And there you start encountering these radical ideas that you'd never really heard before. Like, I had no idea why anyone would have any stigma towards Jewish people. I had no idea. I remember making a thread where I literally asked this question. I'm like, why do you all, and then Dennis Wise's documentary, The Greatest Story Never Told, you know, that's the big one that we're all watching. So I watched that. That was after I graduated. So this is around 2013 that I first watched that one. And that's where, you know, it presents pretty general World War II revisionism. And so I watched that and I was blown away. And so from there, I started to consult some of the resources that were in that documentary, such as Viktor Suvorov's The Chief Culprit. I started to watch videos featuring Ernst Zundel. And I've been getting into the Holocaust Handbooks series. I've started reading books by Pat Buchanan. So it's just this whole world opened up to me. And I've been reading voraciously ever since. I mean, I have books everywhere. So,
yeah, no, I hear you. That sounds exactly like me. I mean, I took a little bit different path. I started researching 9/11. I had never, you know, when I was in college, I was very interested in politics and history and current events and journalism. You know, I always was very interested in journalism. I would read the New York Times and also the local paper in Omaha where I lived. I would read the newspaper front to back like every single day practically. You know, it was something I was really, really into, really interested in. I always wanted to start my own blog. You know, I was reading a lot of anti-war sort of progressive type websites and news sources like Democracy Now. Do you remember Democracy Now? I think they're still around.
Sounds familiar.
Yeah, it's kind of it's run by Amy Goodman, who is Jewish, and it's kind of like a left-wing, progressive, anti-war type news source. So I was kind of, you know, into that. I was very much against the wars. I was very much against the Wall Street bailout. That happened when I was graduating college. I graduated in December of 2008, and the whole Wall Street, you know, crash and the Wall Street bailout, that all happened that fall, so my final semester. And you know, I was watching this all happen, and, you know, all these crooked bankers who I later found out were primarily Jewish, right? Mm-hmm. You know, at the time I didn't really make the connection, but then it was clear that all these people were just total criminals. You know, they just like robbed the entire country and they're getting away with it. They're getting rewarded with bonuses. I mean, it was that outrageous. And so, you know, this was all happening, and I ended up moving to California and I started researching 9/11 because I discovered a 9/11 truth group in San Diego. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and that's really kind of what led me down the path to kind of right-wing politics and looking critically at World War II, for example, and race realism and reading Mein Kampf and hearing what Hitler had to say from his own mouth and, you know, just so many other things, so many other topics that I've written about and discussed on the website, on this podcast. So, yeah, it seems, you know, and it seems like most people who kind of go down this path, we're all the same. We want to get to the bottom of everything and figure out exactly what is going on in the world, exactly what's gone on in history. And we want the truth. And with the internet and with some of the sources we have available nowadays, we can find the truth. You know, we can go online and really figure out what is going on in the world. And
yeah, that's exactly right, John.
Yeah, and present it and share this information with others, whether it's by creating a personal blog like I did or going on Facebook and expressing yourself as you did and I used to do, which we'll get to in a minute. But no, yeah, it's interesting hearing your story because everybody's kind of the same. We're all like nerds about this stuff now. You know, we buy all these books, we read all this stuff, we watch all these documentaries. It's cool. It's really kind of, I don't know, it's something that just clicks and it turns something on in your brain and you just want to get to the bottom of it all.
Yeah, definitely. And I want to kind of add to my own story. I've really always been this way. I remember being in high school and they would teach us about World War II and specifically the Germans. And I remember being unconvinced because of the portrait they were trying to portray of human nature. I'm partially of German descent, like I have a German last name. And thinking about how they're describing the Germans, like I would just think of my own family and I would be like, but my family are so nice. Like, how could this be? Like, how could the Germans be this way? And I remember being a much younger man. And I said to my dad in particular, I was like, you know, they couldn't have all been like devils, you know, like I'm sure some of them were just fighting for their country. So I've always had this. I've always tried to consider things realistically. And I feel like growing up, you're just exposed to propaganda after propaganda. And I can see how for others it can be really easy to swallow. But if you are, I guess it is a fundamental personality thing, like you're saying, how we're all kind of the same. But you have to have this personality where you're critical. You're always critically thinking. And that's where I've come from.
Yep, exactly. Yeah, it's pretty much same with me. I mean, and especially something for me clicked really with 9/11. I mean, I knew I was already, you know, as I said, skeptical of like all the wars we were fighting, all this criminality coming out of Wall Street, these bailouts, et cetera, and just the government in general. I was very skeptical of everything. Mm-hmm. But something really turned on, and I didn't appreciate the extent of just how bad everything really was. You know what I mean? Like, I didn't realize, oh my God, they lied about 9/11, like the most important event that has shaped our current century, you know, like the century we're living in. It's like the defining act right now anyways. And I was just blown away. I could not believe it. And I thought it was such an affront to me as an individual to, you know, I do care about the truth. I do care about honor and dignity. And it's those types of people who are just truly offended and insulted that these people could do these things and think they could get away with it. And we're all going to be too afraid to say something. Well, fuck that.
That element of saying something is extremely true for me. I mean, when you start learning about this stuff, what you feel is anger. Like you really feel angry at these people who have done this to us. And your initial reaction is, all right, I got to get out there and I got to tell people what's going on. And so I guess that's the mistake that I made, like with Facebook, is that I use this as a means to try and tell people about what's like. I had to. It's like the new Eucharist, right? Where you have to spread this good news, except it's horrible news. So it's kind of opposite.
Yeah, no, I hear you, man. I was pretty much doing the same thing at the time. You know, this was like 2011, 2012. I was really kind of starting to get involved in all this stuff. And I was, you know, on my personal Facebook account using my real name, just same thing with my website. I started a blog and I was using my real name saying these things and sharing this information. And it really does totally alienate people. In my case, it certainly did. I mean, you know, people were like, oh my God, John's crazy. What is he talking about? You know? And I get it. Like, I could understand, you know, why somebody would think like that. But what was so disappointing really to me was, I was always saying this. I was like, look, you guys, I know this stuff is radical. It sounds crazy. But look, I'm not just saying this. Like, I've researched this. Like, I know what I'm talking about. I could explain it to you. Like, here's this source. Here's this source. Here's this book. Here's this link. Here's this documentary. You know, so I was like, my God, guys, it's not like I'm just making this up. I wouldn't be saying this stuff if I couldn't prove it, if I didn't know what I was talking about. But even then, like, even some of the people that I considered, like, my best friends, you know, in high school and in college, whatever, they couldn't even deal with it. Never once did someone come up and say, oh, wow, John, that's interesting. Like, why do you think like that? Why are you saying this? That you sound, you know, racist. You sound like an anti-Semite. Why are you always talking about the Jews? No one ever had that intellectual curiosity to come and approach me, even my friends. So it's like, that's to me what's so disappointing with the whole thing. And it's probably not the best idea to go out there and, you know, start spouting off about this stuff, but unfortunately, that's what happens, and, you know, that's what I did. Sounds like that's what you did, and I'm sure there's many, many other people who have done the same thing or something similar.
I'm sure, too, and my case is very similar to yours, except I do have a bit more success. I actually had someone who I wouldn't even consider him to be a very good friend. It's just, you know, one of those people you know in high school. I had, like, 2,500 people in my high school, so, but he messaged me, and he's like, Mark, I'm really intrigued with what you're saying about the Holocaust, and I wonder if you could, like, recommend me any books. And so I did, and that was, I mean, that I got one person to question it. That's enough, I think.
Right. No, and I don't mean to say every single person was like that. I did have plenty of people that were like, oh wow, John, interesting, you know. But like my best friends, none of them were like, you know, interested in hearing me out or anything like that. And that's fine, you know, whatever. That's just the way it goes sometimes. But anyways, yeah, let's kind of jump in, because this is what all the controversy is about, right? I mean, from what I understand, you were making Facebook posts expressing some of these, you know, pro-white revisionist ideas and perspectives, and some students at Virginia Tech, some Antifa-type students, I guess, were investigating it. And forgive me if I'm wrong on some of these details. Why don't you kind of just debrief us and explain exactly what happened, all the controversy surrounding your Facebook posts, your connections to individuals who attended the Charlottesville rally, the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville back in, I think it was August.
Yeah.
Yeah. So go ahead. Why don't you kind of just debrief us?
Sure. Well, I've been making posts like this since, like I said, 2013 or so. Like, you know, I wanted to get that good news out there, or horrible news, however you want to take it. It started when the election came around last fall. At that time, you know, being in a university, especially when you're in the liberal arts, most of the people that you're surrounded by are kind of hostile to you. So I really took it up a notch, and I actively looked for people on Facebook who had similar views, like who are Trump supporters, etc. And I got about like 2,000 people, and most of whom were nationalists, you could say, or at least they were Trump supporters. And so I became progressively more prolific in how many posts I would make. I became progressively more lenient with what I allowed myself to say. And around August, when the Unite the Right rally happened, my wife and I were on vacation in Charleston in South Carolina. And I got a message from my father and my uncle saying, Mark, there's this post by this Antifa, the New River Valley Antifa. That's the area where I live here. And it basically said Virginia Tech has this white supremacist professor, it said, or something like that. And it had all these posts that I'd made, you know, taken out of context and everything. So we all were reporting those posts that were on Facebook. Facebook eventually removed them all. And then the Antifa group created a WordPress, which WordPress seems to be evil and they don't care about defamation or anything. So there's a WordPress where it has all the posts. And that's really when things started. around.
No, Mark. Early... Mark, I'm sorry. Yeah. I hate to interrupt. I'm looking at the post right now. This was September 26th that this post on New River Against Fascism. NewRiverAgainstFascism.wordpress.com. I'll put a link to this in the, you know, in the post for this podcast. So this is the, this is kind of what kickstarted all of this, is what you're saying?
Yeah. Okay. It wasn't posted September 26th. That's just when it was updated recently.
Okay. It, so it was before that. It was before September.
Yeah, it 26th. Was, it was early September, I think.
Okay. Okay.
So early September, my wife and I, we kind of accepted, all right, there's no way to get rid of the WordPress, so I guess the damage has been done. Let's just move on with our lives. Throughout September, it seemed to be decreasing in intensity. I'd been talking to my department chair about all this. She said, my speech is protected. I haven't done anything wrong. They're there to give me any resources I need, like police protection if I feel like I'm in danger. Around the end of September, Tori Cohn, who is kind of, I don't really know how to interpret her. I guess she's like the mastermind behind the campus action. At least that's how I see what her role is. She protested our university president's State of the University address, along with a few other people. And this is a news story as well that you can find. Basically, they held up a big banner and they said, no cake, no, what'd they say? It was like, no fascism, no KKK, no fascist GTA or something like that. And they were like throwing some sort of flyers. So that's when it started to pick up in intensity again. Around this time, I started to see flyers appear around the university with my face on them. And it said, Mark Neuhoff is a self-proclaimed white supremacist teaching at Virginia Tech. Demand to have him fired. And that's when it started to spiral out of control. There's a Medium website where like 40 former English department GTAs all signed a petition saying like they want me to be removed, etc. I was interviewed by the Washington Post, Associated Press picked it up. And that's when it was getting tougher. Me and my wife, that was the lowest period. But it's kind of calmed down by now.
Wow, fascinating. Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, this is going on all over the country. It seems like this is unavoidable now. Like people, normal people like you and me, you know, just making Facebook posts with these ideas and everybody starts freaking out about it, you know?
Especially since mine is like as private as possible. Like every single post on that New River Anti-Fascism page, you can see it has the friends only icon. So it's not like I had my stuff publicly there that anyone could just waltz in and be like, oh, like, okay, here's these public posts. No, it's private stuff. So
how did they get it then?
My theory is that I was friends with a bunch of people that I know went to the Unite the Right rally at Charlottesville. And somehow Antifa must have been mass adding people and their mutual friends who went there. Somehow they discovered that I'm a GTA at Virginia Tech and that I've been making, you know, posts like this. And that's how it started. They even had given to the campus police a picture purportedly of me. And it is a person who kind of looks like me from the side, claiming that I was there. And I wasn't. I was at church that day. So, but in order for them to have that picture, as I was telling you, you'd have to know me, like, because it's just a profile shot and only looks like me because of like how that person's nose is shaped. So I suspect that there might be people in the department as well who are also trying to do this.
Wow. Yeah. Very interesting. Well, so you had kind of talked about the university's response. Have they pretty much been having your back? Like they're not, you know, going to let these people tell them to fire, you know, because a lot of them are demanding that you be fired, as you mentioned. So they seem to be kind of having your side almost.
Yes. And I think that Virginia Tech is a little exceptional in this case. Like I only have praise for what the university has done. I was talking to Peter Brimelow at VDair, and he was commenting how the university president's, Timothy Sands, that's his name, his response to the protest against him, like, he actually threw the protesters out. Like, he had security escort the Antifa people out, and Peter Brimelow thought that was amazing. So he also has only good things to say for the tech administration. But yeah, I've been talking to my department chair, and she's been incredibly supportive. For her, this is a free speech issue. That's what this is. This is an issue of free speech on college campuses. And she suggested to me that rather than fulfilling my final year here teaching, as I've been doing, that I should instead work with her one-on-one to develop free speech classes for the English department. And apparently, I haven't confirmed this, she's updated the our English department's webpage to have some sort of quote saying like how they stand by free speech. So I think that's awesome.
That is incredible. Let me know if you need any help developing free speech courses. I'd love to do that.
All right, I'll keep you in mind.
No, that's cool. I mean, yeah, I think this, our ideas, our perspectives, the free speech issues, all this stuff needs to be presented at the university. I mean, our ideas are never, our perspectives are never presented in a university academic setting when they easily could. You know, our pro-white ideas, you know, race realist ideas, these are all very well founded. And, you know, all the critiques I make against Jews, for example, this could easily be a college course, right? I mean,
yeah.
So anyways, that's interesting. Yeah. Not saying that they'd, you know, go down that path or whatever, but that's very cool. That's a very interesting response. You know, most universities, it seems, would kind of throw you under the bus. And that's not to say that these people are endorsing your ideas. They're just being professional about this and being, you know, true defenders of Western political and intellectual traditions. I mean, we're supposed to be able to say these things publicly and debate them and not have everybody have this, you know, hysterical emotional reaction like the left does every time. And not only the left, I mean, a lot of, you know, mainstream conservatives would say the same thing and demand you be fired.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Another thing, my university, they have had, you know, Charles Murray, the guy who wrote the Bell Curve book, he also did come here. And he did speak. And the same girl, Tori Cohn, who is agitating to get me fired, she also protested his speaking as well.
Yeah. But, yeah, no, I remember you had mentioned that to me. And I kind of want to talk a little bit more about how much do you know about her, Tori Cohn? It's C-O-A-N. So it's not like, yeah, Cohen, like, you know, the typical Jewish spelling of the name. But who is this girl? She seems to have it out for you. And as you said, she seems to be kind of... not a professional activist, but she goes out and, you know, protests a lot of this stuff, it seems like.
She's like a pre-professional activist.
So she is.
she's a member of, like, the Young Democrats at Virginia Tech or something. Before she really got into doing all of this, she had, like, Twitter and Facebook, etc. And for some reason, she deleted all of them. But her, I don't know what it's called, like, her quote under her name on Twitter was something like, she's going after like men or something, like she's fixated on exposing men or something like that. And she's a member of the United Feminist Movement at Virginia Tech as well. So she definitely is an activist. That's very true. She's not a
very far left,
she's not a professional activist. Yeah.
Interesting. So how about the, like, other people on campus, that like the student body? I know she kind of organized a protest, but have there been individuals that have been supportive of you and, you know, come up and talk to you or anything?
I've had an anonymous student email me who seemed like a very, you know, 4chan kind of person with Keck and everything. He emailed me. He's from another university, but he said that there's someone here that supports me. Maybe he was just covering his tracks. But so that's one person. I've also had a student of mine email me expressing support for me. I'm sure my students know what's going on. But none of them have complained. None of them have dropped my class. My students have only come up to me saying they love my teaching style and want to keep taking my classes. So, I mean, the narrative of people like Tory Cohn is because I'm a racist white supremacist, I am impossibly biased in how I'm grading student papers. But the actual reality doesn't reflect that at all. So they're making everything up. There is no issue. I would keep teaching next semester, but because Virginia Tech has been so awesome about all this, I kind of want to, detract from some of the criticism I'm sure that they're receiving and not teach design in the free speech class, which is in its own way a victory, I think.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, that'd be cool to do. Well, you kind of were given an opportunity to express your views in an outlet called thetab.com, which I was assuming this was kind of like Virginia Tech's student newspaper, but is it not? What is the Tab? Do you know?
So our student newspaper is the Collegiate Times. And in August, they reached out to me for an interview. But at that time, I wanted to keep my privacy, so I turned it down. The Tab seems to be written by college students, and it kind of takes a generalist perspective. You can look at their website, and they specifically cover certain universities. Virginia Tech is just one among them.
Oh, I see. Okay. Yeah, I didn't realize that. Well, I read this article, and it basically just is a transcription of an interview you gave with them. So it really allows you to get your ideas and perspectives out there. And this woman, Tori, and the people that think like her, they do present you as this evil racist, white supremacist, etc. So could you maybe just give us the Cliff Notes version of your racial views? Are you a white supremacist?
Sure. So the one post that people are fixated on is one where, and this is on the Antifa website, that WordPress. It starts saying, I'm a white supremacist, and that's where people stop reading. But it's really, it's two paragraphs of a post, and it talks about much more than that. The reason I made the post is because I read an article on VDare by John Derbyshire, where he was saying, what do we on the dissident right call ourselves? And so he went through a list. He's like, are we alt-right? Are we paleo-conservatives? Are we white supremacists? And when he got to that term, he broke it down, saying, our enemies on the left like to throw this word at us, to conjure up images of attack dogs and lynchings and all that. But when we look at white supremacists semantically, it just means a society where the key decision makers are white Europeans. And so I read that and I said, oh, well, that's how America and Europe has always been and should be. So I took that, and in my private Facebook post, I said, sure, I'm a white supremacist in this John Derbyshire way. And then I elaborated. I said that our country is founded on Western culture. Western culture is the culture of white Europeans. And if you replace white Europeans, Western culture, including all the fruits of Western culture, such as freedom of the press, freedom of religion, freedom of speech, all those things will go away because those are unique European ideas. Look at any other society in the world and we don't have this. I wouldn't want to live in Mexico. I wouldn't want to live in Africa. I wouldn't want to live in Asia. I want to live in European countries because they're the best. And it's not a coincidence that European countries are predominantly populated by whites because whites are what made Western culture. Western culture is the culture of white people. And so by saying I'm a white supremacist or I support white supremacy in America, all that I'm saying is America should remain white majority. And that doesn't mean that no one else should be able to have input or no one else should be able to make key decisions. It's just that, and I said this in the Tab, their contribution should really be no more than their percent of the population. So when we talk about Jews, for example, Jews are always a very small percentage of the population, but of course they always are very prominent. They're always prominently influenced in represented in positions of power. And I think that's an issue because why should such a small minority speak for such a majority of people who are unlike them? And it goes beyond race too. It's even politics. so many people in America are conservatives, and for the most part, we're dominated by a liberal elite. So that's what I was saying there.
Yes, very well said. Yeah, and the article is very good. The whole interview, again, is pretty much transcribed. And again, I'll have this linked in the post for this podcast so people can go check it out and read it. And yeah, it's one of those terms. I mean, this is like, again, one of the most weaponized terms of them all. You know, this white, it's so, and it, to me, it's so just childish and ridiculous, the concept of a white supremacist. I mean, it's absurd, and yet it's constantly invoked. And, you know, one of the things, I mean, I remember trying to get to the bottom of World War II and what Hitler was all about, and I ended up reading Mein Kampf. And, you know, Hitler's always presented as this white supremacist, right, that hates all these other people. And I read the whole book, and I'm like, I don't see that anywhere. You know, all he's saying is similar to what you were saying, is that, look, you know, white Aryan people developed and built Western civilization and pretty much all of the architecture, technology, you know, philosophy, culture. I mean, we created all of this culture, all this high culture. And that's basically what he was affirming. And to me, I mean, I had never heard it presented that way, as if it was a good thing, right? I mean, whites are always presented as these evil monsters that have been oppressing all these other people, when this is a total different look at it. And what Hitler was expressing in Mein Kampf was very mainstream at the time. I mean, this was like a you know, what most people thought, even a lot of Americans. I mean, Hitler was deeply influenced, if I'm not mistaken, by Lothrop Stoddard, who wrote a number of books about, you know, the white race and just, you know, racial issues in general. And they were all making this basic observation. And that's what it is. It is just an accurate observation of history. You know, white people did, you know, white countries, white civilizations, Western civilization, we are the ones that created all of this, all this technology and art and culture and everything. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's very good, and it should be preserved and defended. And that's basically all we're saying.
All that's very true. Like, all that we're saying is everything that everyone has always believed until, like, the 1960s. And then suddenly, everything that's commonsensical, now that's all taboo. So now if you say, you know, marriage is for a man and a woman, or if you say countries should exist, or we should, you know, have strong borders, like all these things that shouldn't even be an issue suddenly are massive controversies. And it's ridiculous. Like, everything that we are saying is everything that, like, 99% of everyone in history believed.
It's ridiculous. Yeah. What do you know? Okay. So have you, like, looked into what has caused this fundamental transformation?
Yeah. It's a combination of things. I mean, I know your perspective on it is going to be, you know, the Jewish element, and that's very true as well.
Hey, Mark, by the way, you sound very, like, you got, I don't know, like something's blocking your mic or something. Like, you sound very
faint. Oh, is it better now?
Yes, yeah, go ahead.
Sorry. There's two words that I've seen, and this was in the Occidental Quarterly, I think. It was arguing between, I don't know how to pronounce these even. There's like tellurocratic peoples and thalassocratic peoples. And tellurocratic peoples are predominantly like the poor, peasants. It's people who grow up in one place. They learn to love that place. They develop traditions in that place. And they're very community oriented. That's tellurocratic peoples. Thalassocratic peoples are basically the globalists, or they used to be merchants. They're people who live on the sea. And so these people travel around everywhere. They don't develop any particular attachment to any place. They're not rooted anywhere. They don't have any traditions. They're really the citizen of the world. There's this woman that my university keeps inviting over named, I think, Martha Nussbaum or something. And she always talks about being a citizen of the world. Well, these thalassocratic peoples are always this rich minority, and Jewish people, you know, typically are in this position, but we also see people like, you know, the Rockefellers, the Clintons, the Bushes, all these people who have no attachment to the land, who don't care about the traditions, they're all responsible for this. All these internationalists, all these people like George H.W. Bush, who says we're going to create a new world order, you know, where everyone, where we have open borders, etc. It's really communism on both sides of the equation. When you have open borders, when you have free trade, when you have, you know, universal employment by both sexes, I mean, that's everything that the communists push for. So globalism is really just communism in the 21st century, essentially. That's
right,
the direct
move. Right. Yeah, and I mean, I think that, you know, Jewish communism is basically the alternative to, like, this hyper-international capitalism that prevails in America and the Western world today. I mean, it's basically the same thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah. So, yeah, and I mean, that is essentially what is going on. And, you know, researching World War II and the National Socialists, if you look at that, in my opinion, they had, like, an authentic alternative to these two Jewish systems, which were basically one and the same, communism and capitalism. It was a third way. And we're not even allowed to entertain those ideas in a modern, you know, educational system like a university. We're not even presented this information in any objective way.
And that's really tragic, because what the Third Reich was doing is really no different than what any people have done. Like, they were ethno-nationalists, which virtually everyone has been. You can look at Scandinavia up until really recently with their immigration problem. Like, you can even consider that kind of a version of national socialism, and it worked pretty great because they were homogenous countries. Like, if you have socialism in Sweden, where all the people are Swedish and all the people trust their neighbor, then sure, you can have socialism like worked in the Third Reich, or Japan, or South Korea. These countries are essentially doing the very thing that Hitler was doing in Germany, except they weren't white, so it's okay, and it works for them. But when you have masses of migrants coming to Sweden, now people aren't going to trust their neighbors. Now that system is going to fall apart. So when you remove the homogenous element, when you take away the possibility for ethno-nationalism, then the national socialism that was practiced in the Third Reich kind of becomes impossible. But as you're saying, when you do have that society, I think it's a terrific economic system. I personally am a paleoconservative. I really like Pat Buchanan's ideas.
Right, yeah. No, yeah, he's good. He's very good. He's been saying a lot of these same things. Well, and see, that's the thing. I think that American populism, America first nationalism, that is an alternative to Jewish globalism, whether it's communism or this international capitalism, where there's no
Definitely.
Borders, there's no concern for labor, there's no concern for the environment, there's no concern for anything aside from making money. And that's really what kind of that spirit kind of, that capitalistic spirit kind of prevails in America today, when it doesn't have to be like that. Like, we can make a lot of money and do a lot of good things, and, you know, but we could just do it in a way that advances our own country's interests, our own people's interests. And again, that's what Hitler was doing. I think that's how America was administered for a very long time. You know, again, prior to like 1965, largely, it was kind of geared in that direction. America first. Our immigration policies reflected that. Our industrial policies largely reflected that. So it's all been turned on its head, you know, following World War II, which really was the triumph of Jewish globalism across the entire world.
Certainly. And if you're not going to say America first, or if you're not going to put your country first, then I think it's like, I think Ann Coulter said this, then you're saying America last. I remember one of my peers in my English department here, I was arguing with her on Facebook, and I was basically telling her that, like, if you can't say America first, then your opinion shouldn't matter about the country. Like, what you're saying is completely irrelevant. If you can't bring yourself to say America first, then how is anything that you're doing going to benefit the country? Like, we still live in a time, and it should always be this way, where nation states are the dominant political units. Like, you can't get rid of them. All these ideologies like globalism, communism, etc., they're culture denying. Libertarianism is usually this way too. It denies culture. It denies that people are proud of those cultures, that people have traditions, religions, that they have things that they're proud of, and it instead asserts egalitarianism, that everyone's the same, everyone can subscribe to the same values, and that never happens. America is a unique people. I don't know if you know about Chronicles magazine. They had an interesting article where they're saying the myth of two Americas. There's one America, apparently, that's an idea, another America that's a place. And they're putting to rest this notion that America is an idea. America is a place with a people, with traditions, and with a culture. And we're not just some, you know, egalitarian mass. We're not a nation of immigrants. That's one of the most pernicious myths that proliferates about our country, that we're a nation of immigrants, that everyone can come here. No, we're a people, we're a place with traditions. America first.
I totally agree with you. Very, very well said. Yeah, man, I completely agree. Well, what do you think? I'm curious, what do you think about Trump's kind of civic nationalist, America first populism? I mean, it's kind of in that same vein, although he's not being as sort of ethnic or racial as I think I would be, or I would like to see him be. The Jews certainly portray him that way, but I don't think he really is, like, you know, a racist or something like that.
No, I was recently watching an interesting video where Jared Taylor and Peter Brimelow were talking about Donald Trump. And I think it was Jared Taylor who said this, that if Trump just ran on a position of amnesty, then everyone would love him. Like, all the press would love him. All the liberals would love him, because outside of the immigration issue, like, he's ultimately not that radical in what he's doing. Like, he's not really trying to preserve any American nationalism. Like, he had a lot of rhetoric on the campaign, but we haven't really seen much of it realized. And I don't know if that's because his campaign was just a lot of rhetoric and ultimately empty, or if it, on the other hand, if the deep state, the so-called deep state, is a lot more powerful than we thought it could be, that it could even sabotage Trump. But he's not really doing what a lot of us expected him to do. The whole civic nationalism thing, I mean, the reality of America is that this is a multiracial country. Like, we've always had different racial groups here, but the most important dominant racial group has always been the whites, because this is a Western country. And so it's important that you address the fact that America is multiracial to some extent. I mean, you don't want to be like some of these people I know on Facebook, where they're like, we have to deport everyone who isn't white. I don't think that's very helpful. But you need to ultimately keep in mind that we're a Western country, and that Western culture comes from whites. And there was a speech that he gave in Poland, and Pat Buchanan was praising him here, where he was talking about, like, our heritage. And all the leftists were saying, well, who's us? You know, is he talking about whites? And someone like Jared Taylor would say, yeah, like, it's great that he's saying the white Western heritage. So I don't know. I'm kind of ambivalent about Trump.
Yeah, I hear you. I mean, I think he's great. I mean, he's definitely a breath of fresh air. I mean, I just following him on Twitter alone is enough just to just make me support him. I mean, he's so different than anybody else. And, you know, the ideas that he's expressing are very, what kills me is that they're so just common sense and straightforward. Like, yeah, duh, America first. We're putting our own country first, you know, before anyone else, before any other considerations. And yet the left, these, like, anti-white, anti-American leftists, you know, they view this as, like, racist and wrong and bigoted and, like, evil. It's insane. And, you know, most average, normal, you know, normal Americans entirely recognize the common sense of what Trump is doing and saying.
Yeah, they
but
do.
But no one has ever put it the way that he is doing. You know, no one's ever expressed these ideas in the way that he is. I in my opinion, anyways, I think that's what kind of distinguishes him.
Certainly, and that's why so many people responded to him. I don't remember who was telling me this, but for many people, the prime appeal for Trump was that he was this outsider who spoke in this way. So
exactly, yeah. And I mean, if you go back and listen, like, during the campaign, he was up there talking about how, oh, you know, I used to be, you know, I'd give money to both sides. You know, I know how corrupt DC is. Just making these, you know, common observations that people recognize and understand, but have maybe never heard it expressed by a political figure. You know what I mean? And Trump is just up there exposing this and talking about the media. That's what I think is really important about Trump, is the way he's discredited the fake news media, as he calls them, very accurately. I mean, these people are just total liars. And I've argued for a long time that the media really is the main problem, because they control the narrative, they control the discourse, and it's always framed in ways that are anti-white, that are anti-American, that are against the interests of our country. And Trump is throwing a wrench in that, yeah.
That is definitely one of Trump's primary appeals, and it's a reason why guys like you and America Free Press are really going to have, you know, you're on the upswing now.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think the whole alt-right in general is kind of used this opportunity that Trump has created and just, you know, we're taking advantage of it, or we're trying to anyways. And I think we have done it effectively, you know. I don't know. Do you like consider yourself like in the alt-right?
It's just that that's such a media term, and it instantly conjures up in images, you know, it has a certain image associated with it. I mean, I'm certainly not part of the conventional right. So I guess you could say I'm one of the factions of the alt-right, if we consider it like an umbrella of many different people.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And that's kind of the way I consider it. I mean, I think it's generally good, like what's been going on with it, all the attention it's garnered. And I mean, there's tons of people all over the country, especially on college campuses, maybe, you know, that are getting involved with these ideas and getting involved in, you know, with all the different groups that kind of make up the alt-right. So, I mean, it's good. And I think Trump has really kind of allowed this to happen.
Yeah, he has. I think Richard Spencer is... I think he was saying that, like, during the campaign, we all supported Trump very much, but now it's like, now we're also going to be Trump's biggest critics, because now we have to really make sure that he follows through on everything that he says, you know?
So there's a lot of hope. Absolutely.
It's only been 1 year.
So. Yeah. Yeah. And that's been proven. I mean, think about when Trump launched airstrikes in Syria. The alt-right was upset and up in arms. I know I certainly was. Richard Spencer and those guys were out there, like, leading an anti-war demonstration, like, in Washington, D.C. against President Trump, who they supported, you know, who we all supported, you know, during the election. So, yeah, I think we do need to be objective and truthful about Trump, and praise him when praise is due, and then, you know, criticize him when he needs to be criticized. So, but overall, I mean, I think the way things are going is very good, especially for, you know, pro-white racialist type ideas. It's becoming more and more mainstream. And situations like yours, where your ideas are just being presented to more and more people. You know, I mean, you're just being very rational. For example, the interview in the tab, I mean, you're just presenting your views. I'm reading them. I mean, I'm kind of like a white nationalist, and obviously, and, you know, anti-Semitic, etc. And I'm like, wow, this guy's very tame. I mean, this is not that controversial at all. These are very common sense arguments. So this is good that people are being exposed to these ideas, and the way you put everything is very, I think it comes across very, very well. You know, you don't sound like a quote unquote white supremacist if you actually hear you out, like hear what you got to say. So this is good. I think all this is good.
I think there's a lot of people like me out there. It's people who are working normal jobs and who are afraid. And I think that once we lift the fear of consequence, once we really allow people to speak, we're going to see I'm not unique. People like you and me aren't unique at all. I mean, all this information is out there. Anyone with access to the internet can find any of this stuff. They can read about 9/11. They can read about what really happened in World War II, etc. It's all right there. People just need to read. And I think increasing numbers of people are, especially with Trump continuously calling out the mainstream media for what it is.
Yes, sir. Very well said. Well, Mark, we're right about at the hour mark. I don't know if you have any concluding remarks. Do you have like a website or anything, or are you kind of just, or do you do Facebook even?
No, not anymore. Not after what's happened.
Yeah, no, that's understandable. And you don't have like a blog or anything like that?
No. Maybe I should start one. I don't know.
Yeah, you might have to. I mean, if you're, well, don't get yourself in trouble. I mean, I think you should focus on, I didn't even know about this free speech course that you could potentially develop. I think that's very, very cool. You should definitely pursue that if you're able to. That'd be my advice to you.
Yeah, if I can leave that legacy in the English department of free speech and somehow slip something in there that's pro, you know, what we believe, that'd be a victory, a major victory.
Yes, absolutely. Well, thanks for taking the time. I appreciate it. This was a very good chat. I'll have some links to some of these articles. And yeah, maybe we can do this again in the future. You can give us some updates on what's going on.
Okay, awesome.
Okay, Mark, thanks a lot, man. I will talk to you again real soon.
Okay.
All right.
Nice talking to you, John.
Yep. Bye-bye.